You're listening to Greater LA. It's KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Today, we start with a recent tragedy on the streets of West Los Angeles.
Suspect. Yeah, but they wouldn't tell me who it was.
It wasn't Billy because I saw Billy over here.
Oh, good. Thank God.
It was
early last Wednesday, a homeless veteran living at an encampment outside the Veterans Affairs campus in Brentwood stabbed another homeless veteran to death. A few hours after the killing, other vets living at the camp gathered on the edges of the taped-off scene, like this man, Jeffrey Powers.
I'm freaking out about it.
This was the second killing at this encampment this year. There was another homicide back in April, and one politician wasted no time in calling a press conference. L.A. City Attorney and mayoral candidate Mike Feuer spoke outside the VA just that afternoon.
It is time for this encampment to end, for its residents to be housed, for the sidewalk to be clear. It is time for there to be action.
But in fact, there had been action. A week before the stabbing, the L.A. County Sheriff's Department started an effort to clear the encampment. Deputies interacted with the suspect one day before the veteran was killed there. And for months, nonprofits and government agencies had been doing outreach at that location. Well, now the county supervisor representing the area, Sheila Kuhl, says she wants to get everyone on this street into some kind of housing in the next few months. So what's been going on? How did the violent deaths of two unhoused U.S. military veterans happen right under the nose of county and federal officials? KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here to take us through it all. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
You've reported on this encampment before. It's called Veterans Row. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's right. I've done stories on it before. This summer, I've spent a lot of time there for a project that KCRW will be putting out in the future. It's known as Veterans Row. That's a name given to it by the people who live there. It's not a VA program. It is an encampment, but it looks organized. It's a long row of big matching tents that take up the whole sidewalk on San Vicente Boulevard alongside the wall of that VA campus that you mentioned. And these tents have matching American flags outside. About 40 unhoused military veterans live in those tents. This encampment grew during the pandemic, like many encampments around LA, partly because the city and the county stopped doing big cleanups in line with CDC guidelines.
Okay, so what do we know about this crime?
The victim was a 68-year-old former Marine and Vietnam veteran named Andre Butler. According to witnesses and also the detective who's working the case, Mr. Butler heard some kind of dispute going on in another tent between another veteran and his girlfriend. Butler tried to intervene and ended up stabbed in the neck by the other man, who has been arrested and is in jail.
And what do we know about the suspect?
His name is Darby Sandoval. He's a 36-year-old Army veteran, and he'd been showing symptoms of mental illness for months before this, talking to himself, agitated. In fact, as you mentioned, the day before the attack, Sandoval had an encounter with LA County Sheriff's deputies specializing in homeless outreach. They were on Veterans Row talking to unhoused veterans. They came across Sandoval in his tent, speaking in an agitated way. I don't know exactly what he said, but deputies spent some time interacting with him. And my understanding is that Sandoval stayed in the tent and the deputies made a decision that the best thing to do was not to escalate the situation and to let him be. Here's Lieutenant William Kitchen of the Sheriff's Homeless Outreach Services team talking about that decision.
There was nothing in, from my interaction with him. He wasn't threatening to hurt himself or hurt anybody else. And from being here before, I know he's kind of up and down on the scale. And by the time we left, he was calm and sleeping. You know, I mean, I kind of beat myself up over it last night, too, because, you know, it's an unfortunate incident that I don't think could have been prevented or foreseen.
Certainly a tragic situation, Anna. Just awful. Why can't the veterans at Veterans Row just go over the fence and stay on the campus of the VA?
Well, they could, but it's complicated. Some have cycled back and forth between programs on the campus and the street. There's a small number of permanent apartments for homeless veterans on that campus. Most of the veterans at Veterans Row qualify for other homelessness programs there, though, like a safe camping site that's over the fence or treatment centers or a shelter. And Mike Feuer made this point in his press conference.
No one should live this way, particularly when just on the other side of the fence. There is shelter. There are resources for people experiencing homelessness.
You know, if Mike wanted to truly come out here and do something good to fix a problem, he could have come out and spoke with any one of us, and we would give him a list of things that we could use help with that would reduce the encampment size.
That's Robert Reynolds. He's an Army veteran who served in Iraq and at one point lived on San Vicente himself. Now he lives in an apartment nearby, but he's the main organizer and advocate at Veterans Row. He and unhoused veterans there say that even with the programs that the VA has, they're hard to navigate, especially for people who need the most help, or people leave programs with no housing in place and too often end up on the sidewalk. And over the past year, many have settled in at Veterans Row, which comes with all the dangers of living on the street. People at the encampment have been hit by cars driving on San Vicente Boulevard, which is a big street. There have been overdoses. Now two people have lost their lives violently.
So what are the VA and the county doing to get these vets off the sidewalk and into programs, into housing?
Most days you'll see people from nonprofits, from the LA Homeless Services Authority and the VA out there talking to clients. Over the summer, there were a few town hall meetings between VA officials and homeless veterans. The chief of staff to the United States VA Secretary, Dennis McDonough, even toured Veterans Row back in July. Yet, despite all of that activity, from what I've observed, there seems to be a lack of urgency or coordination in actually moving people off the sidewalk. And let me give you some examples. At one point, a group of roughly 10 unhoused veterans from the encampment were supposed to move together into a new permanent supportive housing complex for veterans in South LA. They agreed to it, and going together was a big part of convincing everybody. But the plan just fell apart. To date, only about 4 veterans who'd been at Veterans Row have moved in, one by one, not together. And only 9 people live in the whole building, which has 32 units. There was also an effort at one point by the LA Homeless Services Authority and a nonprofit to move some veterans from the encampment into hotel rooms. But after identifying a few people who qualified and wanted to go, it just didn't happen.
So do the people at Veterans Row, Anna, do they want help?
It's a very mixed bag of needs, and it's hard to generalize about everyone there. Experts will tell you it can take a Herculean effort to get one person off the street sometimes. And that's probably true here in some cases. People are dealing with addiction. Others are dealing with mental health issues. Some people just need financial help. Jeffrey Powers, who you heard a little bit from earlier, says he's waiting on a housing voucher from the VA to help rent an apartment.
I could not qualify for one because I have to have 2 or 3 times the income of the rent of the apartment. So even if I could afford to pay the apartment, I'm hampered by the fact that I can't get over that barrier without the voucher.
So now the LA County Sheriff's Department is involved after the Brentwood Community Council asked the sheriff, Alex Villanueva, to send his homelessness team in to start working on a cleanup plan. Here's the head of the community council, Michelle Bisnoff.
The fact that we had to rely upon law enforcement and the sheriff to come forward and propose such a program versus the county, which has tremendous resources at this point to address homelessness. The whole thing is very disappointing.
So what does that look like so far?
So far, the deputies have been doing what they call an assessment, coming for a few hours at a time, talking to people on Veterans Row, and in some cases offering them rides to the Dream Center in Echo Park. It's a place with transitional housing for veterans, but nobody has stayed yet. One veteran who was really hoping to go was Doug Biu. He's new on Veterans Row after leaving a shelter at the VA. He wanted to go, but he changed his mind after talking to the deputies because he thought the program sounded very restrictive and similar to a rehab, and he says he's not an addict.
They walked away with no help. See you next week. And I'm scared. You know, I need help. That's what I need. I need help.
So he never even went to the shelter?
No, for now he's still on Veterans Row, but he is still hoping to go inside somewhere.
All right, KCRW's housing and homelessness reporter Anna Scott keeping us updated on Veterans Row and a tragedy there just recently. And Anna, I want to thank you for digging into this. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, as Anna just mentioned, LA sheriff's deputies interacted with the suspect the day before the attack. Those deputies specialize in homeless outreach. But what if you had a team of people who were unarmed and trained in mental health?
All across the country, unarmed crisis response teams are popping up to de-escalate non-emergency mental health situations. The idea is to divert 911 calls away from armed police and into the hands of crisis specialists. Huntington Beach just launched a mobile crisis response team with two trained counselors. Last week, the LA City Council took a step toward developing such a program as well. Both of those are modeled off one program in Eugene, Oregon, that's been around since 1989. It's called CAHOOTS. Ben Adam Clymer worked as a crisis counselor at CAHOOTS for 5 years before returning here to Southern California to help implement similar programs in this area. Hey, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm all right. So CAHOOTS stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. It is a partnership between, up in Oregon it is, between the Eugene Police Department and the nonprofit called White Bird Clinic. Talk about exactly what that program does.
CAHOOTS responds to a wide array of different types of calls, from basic welfare checks to suicidal folks to family disputes, anything and everything that you could possibly imagine that somebody might call for assistance on that is not a criminal or a violent issue. It's not a medical emergency. It's not a fire. And CAHOOTS sends out a crisis intervention worker and an EMT to manage and deal with those circumstances. One of the unique parts of it is that it actually is integrated into that dispatch system. And so while there are a lot of different types of crisis intervention teams out there in the country, none of them have quite that same dispatch system where the team is actually sent as the first responder to these types of calls.
And this program, Ben, has been around for 30 years, more than 30 years, in Eugene. Most cities and counties are just now starting programs like this or don't have programs like this. Why is that?
There has been a lot of efforts to create teams like this, but they have often been laid at the feet of, especially in California, at the feet of health care agencies, the health authorities, saying, well, you know, these types of calls really belong to the health authorities who are in charge of mental health, who are in charge of the social safety net. And I think that generally that's been a really positive effort. We've got a lot of really great teams out there. In LA County, it's PMRT. In Orange County, it's CAT team. But the reality on the ground is that mental health calls are often coming in as suspicious person or a welfare check or something else that's really not labeled a mental health call. It's labeled something else. And so police have still been really the primary responders to those types of circumstances.
I want to talk about this homicide that took place on Veterans Row last week. As our reporter Anna mentioned, deputies did interact with the suspect the day before. They thought they had de-escalated the situation, but then the next day, that same man allegedly stabbed someone. I mean, could that have been prevented if, say, a crisis counselor had interacted with the man instead? Or is it, I mean, you know, is forecasting danger nearly impossible? Can you foresee something like that happening?
I think that anybody who tells you that they can foresee it is probably not telling the truth. I think that the thing that would most beneficially prevent that kind of stuff is getting people off the street and helping them, you know, get into more secure and stable locations where they don't feel like they're in threatening circumstances all the time, where they don't feel scared because they're worried somebody's going to take their stuff or attack them or whatever. But I don't think that a team like this would have necessarily prevented a circumstance like that. That's too much of a hypothetical. I can't say specifically.
I mean, how prevalent is mental illness on the streets? I don't know if that's a question you can answer, but I'm gonna give it to you anyway. And what is the law, Ben, when it comes to getting mental health care to people who are unable to do it for themselves? I mean, is there a law? What's a way to prevent things like this from happening in the first place?
I think that it's important to remember that not everyone goes onto the street just because they're having mental health crises. However, once they're on the street, it becomes very easy to have a mental health crisis, no matter who you are. simply because it's an overwhelming, traumatizing experience. And so, you know, in terms of how prevalent is it, I mean, it's very prevalent because just the experience of being on the street is an overwhelming crisis event. It's a crisis event that goes on day after day until it ends. And even then, it still lives with you. You know, that trauma still resides in you. And so, you know, what are the laws? Well, the laws are tricky because we don't want to sort of force people. We don't want to use coercion to put them into better circumstances. We would really like to offer them those circumstances and work alongside them and work with them. So, you know, the legal system, there are some times when people can get into that space where they are sort of forced, for lack of a better word, into mental health care and all that kind of stuff, where they get put on conservatorships and things like that. But those are few and far between because somebody's got to be really, really, really bad. They've got to be at a state where they're going to die if they don't get that help. And they're going to die soon. So it's a tricky situation.
I mean, you see people, like, I'll be driving down the street and I'll see somebody just laying on the sidewalk, you know, who's obviously in some sort of distress or whatever it may be. And it's like, I'm heartbroken by that because you want to help someone, but you feel like that help isn't available. Like, you know, where's the help for that guy or that woman who's just laying there in public and you know, speaking into thin air or you know, I mean, I don't know what to do in a situation like that. And the question is always on my mind, where is the city in a situation like that?
I think that one, the problem is severe and we can't get to every circumstance. I think two, that those are exactly the types of calls that we respond to on the CAHOOTS program. And, you know, the amazing part of that experience is that you go out, you meet with that person, and because we're able to transport people to places, we're able to take them to a drop-in center, to a shelter, to a place where they are no longer having that public mental health crisis. And while we didn't resolve their entire issue, we didn't end their homelessness, we didn't end their mental illness, we at least for that moment were able to connect them to a place that was able to give them more support than what they are getting by just kind of standing in the park yelling or, you know, being on the street corner having a horrible day. And so, you know, that's really the goal of creating programs like this in terms of what we're doing in Huntington Beach, in terms of what we're doing in other parts of Orange County, and what the city is attempting to do with the passage of the moving forward with creating a new program.
It can be heartbreaking. It certainly, there is some hope, though, in programs like this, I would imagine. Ben Adam Clymer, who manages crisis intervention teams in Orange County. He's also worked as a crisis counselor up in Oregon at CAHOOTS, a program that LA is using as a model as well. Ben, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to be able to talk with you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Hate crimes targeting Asian Americans are up across the country, across the state of California, and in Orange County. A new report finds that overall police documented 112 hate crimes and 263 hate incidents in the OC last year. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano's here with KCRW's Orange County line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
What is the difference, okay, first and foremost, between a hate crime and a hate incident?
A hate crime, something that's got to rise up to the level of a misdemeanor, of a felony. So we're talking about an assault. We're talking about a vandalism. We're talking about defacement, anything like that. A hate incident is just going to be someone being stupid. Well, hate crimes, trust me, are very stupid. But in terms of just like saying racial epithets, just, you know, or making remarks, you know, ridiculing somebody's race or ethnicity or also their sexual identity and whatnot. So it does, but it, as angry and as horrible as that may be, hate incidents don't rise up always to the level of a hate crime, at least in the eyes of the law.
It's not just Asian Americans, though, right? I mean, what are the groups mostly being attacked this way? There are so many groups, right?
Oh, you know, I've said this for so long. Orange County continues to be a capital of hate, even as it gets more purple. It's disgusting, but sadly, I'm never surprised. The one group that actually gets the most hate crimes against them are African Americans, or blacks. Followed number two by Jews, by Jewish individuals. And what's shocking a lot of people right now, though, sadly, like hate crimes against Jews and blacks are not surprising in Orange County, because Orange County is Orange County. What is shocking people right now is just the incredible rise in hate crimes and hate incidents against Asian Americans. Asian Americans are a significant minority in Orange County, in, you know, both down in Irvine, Little Saigon. And so in 20, you know, usually there's about 4 to 5 anti-Asian hate related incidents a year, tracked by the Orange County Human Relations, which does a great job every year doing that. In 2020, you logged 76 hate incidents. That's an increase of over 1,000%.
I want to dig into these numbers a little bit. It was up sharply, mostly driven by incidents against Asians and Asian Americans. How are people explaining, Gustavo, these big increases?
Obviously, with Asian Americans, it's COVID-19. The idea, of course, early on that the virus came from China, that was orchestrated by China, and that somehow, of course, in the Orange County mind, well, if it came from China, then obviously all Asians are, it's their problem, whether you live in Malaysia, in the Philippines, or Pacific, or even Hawaii, or whether you're fifth generation Japanese American or even longer with Chinese. So that's really what it matters. And of course, we live in an era where there's just so much vitriol online, which spills over to real life. You had an election in 2020 that wasn't exactly the kindest of elections. So it was just a perfect maelstrom to have more and more anti-Asian and just all hate incidents and hate crimes to exponentially grow in Orange County.
There are, you mentioned the crimes and the incidents documented by the police. Not every instance of, say, a piece of graffiti that has a swastika or someone yelling abuse, for example, is going to be reported to the police. So do we assume that the actual numbers are even higher?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's how it's always been. Anyone who, you know, anyone who grows up a minority in Southern California, they have a story of them being, you know, either harassed if they're lucky, or just even something as a lazy stereotype as like, oh, I didn't know they allowed Mexicans in here. I always tell the story when I was once at the Balboa Club in Newport Beach. This is about 15 years ago. Just because I was wearing a guayabera, the people there, the old timers there, they thought I was one of the busboys. And so they would say, hey, can you go get my car? Can you go get my car? And this happens again and again, and you laugh it off if you have a thick skin, but none of us should be dealing with that crap.
Yeah, I mean, and that's not a crime, that's just crap, like you said.
Yeah,
right? I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
Well, what I told them was like, yeah, I'll go get your car, but you're just not going to get it back ever again.
You know, and think about the incident, and again, maybe a crime, especially with rock throwing, but earlier this year we spoke to the father of a Chinese family in Ladera Heights. Some teenagers had been throwing rocks at their house and yelling abuse, banging on the door at all hours of the night. You know, it took neighbors to get together and do shifts sitting outside that house to put a stop to it. You know, you can't just leave it up to well-intentioned people, though, to take care of a situation like that, right? Because that's a bunch of crap.
And this is what the important point of the Orange County Human Relations, which now has been around, I actually think this might be their 50th anniversary. They've been around since the early 1970s. And what they try to do is like, look, you're not going to be able to stop all hate crimes, all hate incidents. It's impossible unless you have like an Orwellian apparatus, which nobody wants. But what you can do is go to the elementary schools, go to the high schools, and teach anti-bias training, and teach the very simple things like, hey, Hate is not cool. Racism, bigotry, it's not cool. Even in a joking matter, it's not cool. And the Human Relations Commission has always been controversial in Orange County because of that, because they want to teach decency on those levels. Like, before critical race theory was a thing, the Human Relations Commission was teaching folks, like, hey, there are some groups that are going to have a little bit more privilege. Check your privilege at the door. And I've been tracking them for years, and they've always done good work.
LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano with today's KCRW Orange County Line. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, the solutions and problems created by so-called concierge medicine. Some folks can afford to pay for the extra attention and care, but what about the rest of us dealing with healthcare? That's tomorrow. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl all had hands and ears on tonight's show. I'm Steve Chiotakis, thanking you for your ear this evening. Have a great night.